Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone, episode 59. My name is Kieran, and as always, I'm joined by my good pal out in the United States, JJ Duke. How are you, mate?
Yeah, Kieran, good. Seems like we're finally getting into the winter months now.
Yeah, winter months, chill's coming, but the soccer carries on, or the football carries on, depending on what part of the world you're from. But I reference soccer first, because we are going to start with news that's been going on in the United States. And JJ, day of recording, we have been made aware that Laura Harvey will be taking over the Salt Lake City NWSL franchise. We haven't even talked about that yet, because that obviously happened in between the last couple of shows. But we'll talk about that in a minute, but obviously Real Salt Lake, the MLS side, have announced that they are going to have an NWSL franchise from 2018. They will be taking over the registration of the league, or registration within the league, of FC Kansas City. There were murmurs that FC Kansas City may be looking to relocate the franchise. That did happen and has happened, and that will mean that those players from FC Kansas City will be moving to Salt Lake City. We don't know the name of the franchise in Salt Lake City yet. They will come under the Real Salt Lake MLS side. But JJ, talk about FC Kansas City first, because two NWSL championships, it's another team following in the footsteps of the Western New York Flash, who have won a championship, who will be relocating. It's a shame for the city of Kansas City, isn't it? Because they had a very, very good team. They didn't have the best 2017, but a very good side there, and a huge loss to the city, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure for the people that supported the team, because a lot of us know that covered the U.S. game, very good support, very passionate supporting group of FC Kansas City. But I think, Kieran, and you and I have talked about this in the past, that this is really starting to be the trend now for this American-based league, is they are no longer looking towards independent ownership groups. They're looking for teams that kind of fall under an umbrella, whether it be an MLS side, an NASL side, USL side, maybe down the road. Those are the primary men's leagues here in the U.S., but they're looking more towards those, as opposed to, well, we got a collection of people that want to purchase a women's soccer team. They're staying away from that. So it's interesting, because now obviously we've had Houston come in, we've had the North Carolina franchise coming in, we've had now the Salt Lake team coming in. I mean, it speaks a lot about where this league wants to go. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is obviously much different than where it was in the past in WPS, and for that matter WUSA, where there were no MLS interests. But let's face it, at that time the men's leagues were still not in its infancy. Maybe the first one, WUSA, sure, but WPS, not so much. I think now it's at the point for these men's teams where they have the finances available to go out and support extra teams in addition to their men's side.
Yeah, of course. And Sporting Kansas City, of course, the MLS team within the area, was linked to potentially taking on the side, but that never materialized and came to nothing. We now have a division of 10 teams, and as you say, five of them now have some form of association with a men's side. Obviously, Portland were already an established side from the very beginning. We've then since seen Houston, North Carolina, Orlando, and now we have Real Salt Lake. You're right, I think this potentially is going to be the model moving forward. And of course, it, again, only rumors, but there are suggestions that maybe the Boston Breakers might be going that way as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that would be disappointing if it is true, because I know the people up there in Boston, especially the front office, they've been passionate since day one of basically professional soccer in the United States. You could find the Breakers being, you know, linked in one form or another is the same name back in WSA. Now really this ownership group is kind of been there since day one of WPS, so that would be really disappointing that if it were the case, but you can understand that. I mean, there have always been rumors about teams X, Y, and Z who are not affiliated with the men's side or not affiliated with, you know, some sort of a company that can handle more than one team. And yeah, now all of a sudden, you know, from the original eight teams, we're just down to a handful because franchises are moving. And, you know, at the end of the day, Kieran, you and I know this well, money talks. And if the money talks, then that's where it's going to go.
Yeah, without doubt. I mean, it would be easy for us to kind of try and have a chat about what impact this will have on the city of Kansas City. But I actually had a chat with Ashley Scobie. Ashley is a former reporter for the Kansas City Star. She actually covered FC Kansas City in 2016. And I thought, living in the area, having covered the team, it would be good to get some insight from someone who's been close to that side in the past. So myself and Ashley had a 5-10 minute chat about FC Kansas City and what this might mean. So here's Ashley having a chat about the situation in Kansas City. Okay, so I'm delighted to be joined by Ashley Scobie, who is a former Kansas City Star sports reporter and a current freelance writer, covered FC KC during the 2016 NWSL season. Ashley, how are you?
I'm fabulous. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So the reason we've got you on the show is it was announced in the last couple of weeks that the FC Kansas City are no more. The players will be transferred over to the new franchise in Salt Lake City. We're still awaiting the name of that club and a few more details. But you covered FC KC in 2016 for the Kansas City Star. I guess my first question is, from someone who lives in the area, you will have maybe seen more of the publicity and the coverage of what's going on locally. What's kind of been the reaction in Kansas City after the news that the FC KC are no longer going to be in the city?
Yeah, I think fans, I mean, the fans that were there, you know, obviously they're not drawing the same amount of fans as like the Royals or something. But the fans that did come to the games and had been coming to the games for years were pretty devastated, and it kind of took them by surprise. You know, I think there had been a lot of talk about, you know, maybe they're going to move the team and everything that went down last year. You know, there was kind of that question up in the air. But I think people had almost, you know, after they stayed in the city last year, they had almost kind of, you know, thought they were safe almost. So I think it kind of took everyone a little bit by surprise. But at the same time, you know, they were really kind of devastated about it. I think FC Kansas City fans did a really great job of getting to know the players here, especially. In WSL, a lot of teams fans do that. There is kind of that closer relationship between fans and players. But especially so, I think, in Kansas City, because we are kind of a smaller city. And I think fans, you know, they were just really devastated. This is something that they had done for a lot of years. They really got to know the players, got to know Vlatko and Donofsky, and really came to love everyone here. So to see them kind of ripped away really suddenly, it was, you know, kind of came as a shock. And people were just, you know, really sad about it.
I know you didn't cover the team in 2017. I know you kind of followed the team from afar, but in the year that you did cover them in 2016, what did you kind of gain in terms of the feel that people locally had for the club? And I know they have the supporters group, the Blue Crew. You will have had the opportunity yourself to interview players, and we'll maybe talk about that in a minute. But in terms of what FC KC meant to those fans, how big of a loss is it for them in particular?
You know, I think it is a big loss because Kansas City, you know, first and foremost, is a great sports town. You know, and I think a lot of cities will say that. And I kind of come in as a transplant. I had never really been to Kansas City before I moved here. But people, I mean, really do live and die by the teams here. You know, whether that's the Royals winning the World Series or, you know, the Chiefs, you know, wanting the Chiefs to finally win a playoff game. You know, they really do love their teams here. And the FC Kansas City fans are no different. They really came to love that team. And this is a kind of a big loss for them because, you know, for better or for worse, NWSL tickets are a lot, you know, cheaper to get. It's a lot easier to bring a family to an FC Kansas City game as opposed to, you know, a sporting game even, or a Royals or Chiefs game. So I think that, you know, families and especially like younger, you know, especially female soccer players, you know, they had these great role models to look up to. I know FC Kansas City has a club team here as well for the younger players. And I think, I don't really know what's happening with that. But even just to lose those, you know, great female role models in the community, I think that's kind of a big hit, especially for younger female fans.
Did you have any inkling in 2016, in the year that you covered, that there might be any doubts about the team's kind of long-term future?
Oh yeah, I think so. You know, we had been hearing for a little while that, you know, everything had gone down with the former owners. And then, you know, when the new owner came in, he was kind of this, you know, mystery figure. You know, he lived in Minnesota and no one really knew, you know, who he was or why he bought the team. He didn't really, you know, have much of a vision that he spoke about publicly. So I think obviously that created a ton of questions. You know, when there's not that strong leadership, that strong ownership that's saying, here's what we're going to do with the team, here's the plan for the future, I definitely questions arise. So I think people kind of started to have doubts even last year, you know, with the ownership change.
So I'm going to assume that from your point of view, it wasn't really a surprise when the news was made public that the team was going to be no more.
I think it kind of surprised me the way that it happened, because I think even at this point, people are a little confused about, you know, the team technically folded, but all the players are moving. So why wasn't this just considered, you know, a team moving to another city? And there are just a lot of questions. But as far as, you know, I don't think we're terribly, terribly surprised that, you know, this ownership group is not owning a team in Kansas City anymore. I don't think that comes as a huge shock.
Well, you will have been closer than most in the year that you covered the team. Tell us about what a special team it was. Won two NWSL titles. You talked about some of those female role models, the likes of Becky Sauerbrunn, who many will know as being one of the linchpins of the US women's national team. What sort of team are the community losing? What sort of a team is that, or was that, FC Kansas City side?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Becky Sauerbrunn in particular, you know, she is, you know, she's this huge figure in women's soccer. From the fight for, you know, equal pay, and, you know, creating the NWSL Players Association, being involved, you know, at all those levels. I mean, that's a huge figure for Kansas City to lose. It's an absolutely huge figure for them to lose. And then, you know, Vlatko Andonovski, I mean, fans absolutely loved him. He was one of the most interesting coaches I think I've covered. I've kind of been all over the map with people that I've covered, but Vlatko Andonovski was always kind, you know, to every single fan. He made a point, you know, to talk to everyone after games. He put so much time and energy into building, you know, the program here. The program, that's kind of a college term, but building the franchise here. And I think that will be hugely missed. I think even, you know, before the news came out that Kansas City, the team wasn't going to be here anymore, I think losing Andonovski was kind of a big hit for fans as well. You know, even if the team had stayed here and they had to switch coaches, I think that would have been a huge loss for the fans, because they really did come to love him.
For those of us outside of Kansas City and more than likely outside of the United States, for those that have an interest in women's soccer in Kansas City, is there a landscape there? Is there a program that maybe fans can transfer their loyalties to, the college system perhaps? What's the kind of women's football, women's soccer landscape like in Kansas City?
I mean, there's not a huge scene, I would say. I mean, we don't have a ton of college teams necessarily in Kansas City. I know that University of Kansas in Lawrence, about 45 minutes away, that team has had a lot of success. So I think, you know, kind of transferring loyalties to that would be possible. And I do think that, you know, with this team, with FC Kansas City being here, fans kind of got to know a lot of the players. I think they will continue to follow those players. You know, if Becky Sauerbrunn is playing for, you know, Salt Lake, whatever the name of the team is going to be, I think they're still going to follow her and still cheer on that team. Locally, you know, there's I mean, obviously, Sporting Kansas City is here on the men's side. But as far as the women's side, I mean, it's, you know, I think they will continue to follow, you know, the same players and of course, Andonovsky as well.
Do you think fans have got perhaps a fair reason to be maybe a little bit disappointed that Sporting Kansas City haven't perhaps shown more of an interest in FC KC and could have kept the side locally?
Oh, for sure. And obviously, I don't know, you know, all of the details, and I don't know why that partnership wasn't, you know, in the cards. But I do think it is disappointing for fans because we have seen, you know, MLS teams partner with NWSL teams to great success. I mean, you look at Portland, Houston's done it as well. I mean, there is a lot of success in that kind of partnership. So I think a lot of Kansas City fans are wondering, you know, why is that not possible here? And I think if, even if they receive some kind of an explanation as to why, you know, it's possible there is, you know, a great explanation for why Sporting was not interested or why it didn't happen. But I think the fans kind of want to know why that was the case. Why, you know, why did they not step in and kind of save this team? Because it's always a disappointment when, you know, a team bolts out of a city, you know. I'm funnily enough, I'm wearing a Seattle Supersonics sweatshirt right now because, I mean, that's a great example. Anytime a team is kind of ripped away, you, fans are left to wonder, you know, what could have been done to keep it here. So I think that's always a disappointment and it's always a question.
Yeah, completely alien to us over here in the UK. it just doesn't happen. I think there's probably one example where Wimbledon Football Club were relocated to Milton Keynes. But just my final one, you kind of did touch on maybe fans will continue to follow players that kind of venture off to Salt Lake City. Do you think that FC KC fans might spread their loyalties around the league based on players that they follow? Or do you think that they're very much, that the interest was in the fact that the team was in Kansas City and actually they won't be too fussed where those players go or they won't be too fussed about following the Salt Lake City franchise?
I think it's a good question. I'm kind of curious to see how it all plays out because I do think, you know, like I said, fans built kind of that relationship with the players. They really love them. And I think they'll continue to follow them regardless of the team. But I do also think that Kansas City as a city itself is kind of prideful. You know, they're proud of Kansas City. They love to say, not just I'm a Royals fan or Chiefs fan, I'm a Kansas City Royals fan. You know, they love that the team is part of their city. It's part of, you know, you know, Kansas City is growing a lot and the sports teams are a huge part of that growth. So I do think that part of it was, you know, this is a team that's part of our community and we're going to jump behind it. But I do also think that they'll continue to follow the players. I think they'll probably, you know, still cheer for Vlatko Andonovsky, you know, in Seattle at a certain, you know, to a certain point. Especially since, you know, there's nothing here necessarily for them to cheer for. You know, it's not like if they're cheering for those players or coaches or whatever, that they would be cheering against their own city at this point. If there ever, you know, was a team that came back to Kansas City or something, I think it might be different, but I do think that they'll, you know, kind of continue to follow those same players.
So JJ's Kansas City say goodbye. We welcome whatever the name will be of the Rail Salt Lake side. Laura Harvey was announced as the head coach on the day of recording. A bit of a surprise, I think, initially when those rumours started to circulate. But I know, again, credit to Richard Farley. He was the person who kind of put it out there that it looked like it was going to happen. Gained some momentum very, very quickly. And all of a sudden, we see her not long after leaving the Seattle Reign announced as the Salt Lake City coach for the very first time. I'd be interested to get your take on that because it looked like she might be heading into an international role at one point.
I find it a little bit funny because a long time ago there was a website that was devoted to whenever Laura Harvey made a move with the Seattle Reign. I believe it was Has Laura Harvey Made a Trade Today.com. It would go berserk if it happened. This was obviously the Seattle Reign offseason leading into 2014, where she basically overhauled the team in 1 year. Is it kind of ironic that she almost kind of trades herself from one team to another? I personally think so, but I'm also someone that's not surprised to see her name pop up that quickly. Yeah, it'd be great to see her on an international level, but you know what? I think After watching her do what she did with Seattle and really bringing that club into the forefront and playing some very good soccer at the same time, yeah, she'd be the perfect model for the job in Salt Lake. Now, we don't know what the identity of the team is going to look like. We don't even know a logo of what the team is going to be. But what we do know is Harvey knows how to get the best out of her players. She's going to be inheriting, we understand, you know, a decent roster from FC Kansas City. We don't know how many will actually still be playing as of next year, because there could be players that will retire, want to look for other opportunities, or whatever have you. But she can get the best out of the players. And I wouldn't also be surprised that maybe there might be some other moves happening to really make Salt Lake, or this Utah-based, with air quotes, NWSL franchise, be one of the top teams coming next year.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we thought, as I mentioned, she would be going into an international role. You mentioned there the website of, has Laura Harvey made a trade yet? She described it on the teleconference as the ultimate trade. She has essentially traded places with Vlatko Andonovski. He's obviously gone to the Seattle Reign. I wonder if they might swap a few players as well, mate. Could we see some potentially some familiar faces lining up with Laura Harvey and Vlatko Andonovski come the start of the season?
I wouldn't be completely shocked, let's just put it that way. But I know those two have the great amount of respect for each other and how they play, or how they, you know, manage their teams and the style of game that both of them go about their business. And yeah, you know, if there was someone to trade spots with Laura Harvey, I probably would have put Vlatko as that number one job. And yeah, you know, end of the day, I'm curious to see how both Seattle next season, as well as Salt Lake, they're going to look on the field, because, you know, two different coaches, two different locations. But yeah, you know, you said it right. We could have some players moving, or we might see a lot of the same. You never know.
Well, I managed to sit in on the teleconference for the announcement of Laura as Real Salt Lake's new head coach for their NWSL franchise. So you can hear a little bit from her introducing herself to the media and taking a couple of early questions. And of course, I had to ask her about the situation surrounding her links to the England national job. And she was very open and admitted that there were talks, but felt that it was best to stay in the NWSL. So here's some audio from that teleconference.
Morning, people. Thought you got rid of me, but you didn't. I think I just want to say I'm really excited for this opportunity. I think when I resigned from the Reign back at the beginning of this month, I'm not sure this was the place I thought I would end up, but having spoken to Deloitte and going out and meeting the guys out in Salt Lake, I'm really excited for this opportunity. I think what the club's looking to build and the vision that it has is super exciting, not just for me, but I think for women's soccer in the United States. I think everything that we're trying to do, from facilities, from the environment that the players are going to have, is going to be world class, and that's something that I'm really excited about. And yeah, just looking forward to getting going.
And our first question comes from Maddie Lee from Salt Lake Tribune. Please go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Congratulations. First of all, I'm excited to meet you here, actually, in Salt Lake. But when you left the Reign, I'm assuming you didn't think that you'd come straight back to the NWSL. What about this opportunity changed your mind?
Yeah, no, I definitely didn't think I was going to come back to the NWSL, especially this quickly. I think that there was multiple things that went into me changing my mind, but I think I looked at some international opportunities and they didn't quite, A, feel right for me right now, or didn't go the way that I thought they were going to. And then I got a phone call from Deloitte, and just speaking to him for 20 minutes, I could see that he had a passion for the game. He really wanted to get a franchise and a club that was going to be successful. And, you know, 2-3 days later, I was in Salt Lake, and the moment I walked around the facilities and spoke to Craig and Rob and Trey and the guys that are there running the club, you can see that they all have the same vision and same drive that Deloitte has, which was something that I just thought I wanted to be a part of. So yeah, it wasn't necessarily the direction that I originally planned on. And I think when I resigned, Salt Lake wasn't even in the mix at this stage. So definitely wasn't planned. But yeah, I'm really excited about it. really stoked to get out there and get my feet on the ground and get back to work real quick.
Hi, Laura. I think you know where this one's going. Congrats on the role. I know the NWSL means an awful lot to you, but I've got to ask about the England role. You're obviously linked with it. Were there ever any talks with the FA? Was there ever something that could have happened? And if so, what was it that made you decide that staying in the NWSL and the role with Salt Lake City was one that you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go into loads of detail. I don't think that would be fair. But yes, there were some conversations, but it was a decision that I think was mine. And there's multiple reasons behind that. A lot of them were based off, you know, what I think I need for my career right now. And, you know, the England job is up there with one of the best jobs in the world, undoubtedly. But I think for me right now, staying stateside, continuing to grow as a coach was what I believed was the right thing. And like I said, you know, the moment I landed in Salt Lake and spoke to the guys and saw the vision of what they were trying to do, it was really difficult for me to turn my back on that, honestly. And you've known me a long time. I'm pretty transparent about how I am and who I am. And I think that, you know, I just felt that this was the right fit for me right now.
So JJ, we'll talk a little bit about what's been going on in Europe shortly, but one thing that did happen in the United States that's worth mentioning is we've talked about Vlatko Andonovski, we've talked about the Seattle Reign. They will have a new number 9 playing for them in 2018 because they announced the signing of Jodie Taylor from Arsenal on the expiry of her contract. So Jodie will be going down to the W League initially to go and play for Melbourne City. So she'll be playing alongside Jess Fishlock. And then she'll be playing alongside Jess Fishlock when they both return to the NWSL. What did you make of that move? Because I actually think it's a good one and a good fit for Jodie.
I loved it personally because, you know, she's one of these players that just loves playing in the U.S. Obviously, we know her ties to the country, played collegiate soccer here, spent time with Portland as well as Washington in the past, and is someone that enjoys this league and this atmosphere. You know, I did see a little bit of mixed reaction on social media after the announcement, but I'm a little surprised to see that because this is a striker right now that's on form. You know, brilliant Euros, good start to the WSL season with Arsenal, but this move made sense on a number of reasons. One I've already explained, the other being, as you and I've pointed out frequently, that Arsenal team, I think there are just too many players for not enough spots in that starting 11. So what happens, some players need to find opportunities overseas or elsewhere, this being overseas, and I think this is a great move for Jodie in her career.
I think it was always going to happen, mate. I think it was always going to happen. Very much classes the US as her home. Obviously went to university in Oregon, played for the Portland Thorns. That one did not shock me in the slightest, and really wish her well when she goes over to Seattle. That's not the only move that has taken place. There's been a few moves within Europe as well, mate. Wolfsburg, you talk about Arsenal having a strong squad and not being able to fit everyone in. I do wonder where Wolfsburg are going to be able to fit in their latest recruits, because they're two very, very good signings. They've managed to recruit Christina Minder from Linköping, the Norwegian midfielder, and her teammate Claudia Neto as well, who obviously represented Portugal in Euro 2017. Both very, very good midfielders, both international calibre. They will be joining Wolfsburg. Mate, I don't even know where those two fit in, because Wolfsburg are already stacked.
Yeah, they are. I mean, obviously, as we know, they have got a competitive schedule coming up over the next few months, and we're going to touch on their Champions League draw. But yeah, you can't ever have enough squad rotation, but I'm with you. It was confusing in that move because, yeah, you look at how, as you say, how deep that squad is at the moment. But at the same time, you know, it's similar to the Jodie Taylor move. I understand it. You have to kind of go with that. And if it's opportunities there for those players to get themselves, not to say surrounded by better facilities, better training, blah, 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 because Linköping, obviously, they also made it to this exact same stage here in the Champions League in quarterfinals. But you know, it must have just presented themselves as that right opportunity.
Yeah, it's difficult because obviously there's a winter window where teams can start to recruit players again. Linköping not only have lost Minder and Nato, they've also lost Jonna Andersson, their Swedish defender who's joined Chelsea Ladies. Now, I think those three players will be cup-tied for the second half of the Champions League. I don't think they'll actually be able to play because they've already represented Linköping in the competition. I'd need to double check that. We're still waiting to see if Ella Massa is going to be going to Wolfsburg. We understand that one's going to happen, but I don't think that one has been made official yet. Those are the kind of the high profile moves that have been made. And I think before we move on to the situation surrounding Denmark, mate, we should talk about the UEFA Women's Champions League. You've mentioned it there. The quarterfinal draw took place last week. We're now into the business end of the competition. There's some really good draws, isn't there? I'll run through it very quickly. We've got Montpellier of France taking on Chelsea. We've got Wolfsburg against Slavia Prague of the Czech Republic. Manchester City taking on a team we've just been discussing, Linköping from Sweden. And then I think the one that a lot of people have got their eye on, the holders Lyon, taking on the very ambitious FC Barcelona. Those ties are due to be played on the 21st and 22nd of March and the 28th and 29th of March. Two legs, as always. JJ, what was your reaction and what's the standout there for you?
Well, you talked about the very ambitious Barcelona. This is truly now the put-up-or-shut-up moment. You spend all this money, you get in all that quality talent, Tony Duggan, Lika Martins, obviously. Now you come up against, which I think you and I have been pretty honest in saying, one of the best dynasties in modern European women's football, and really club women's football for that matter, in Lyon. They've been there consistent every year, getting to the final, probably the deepest squad in all the land. So if you're Barcelona, I think, you know, you want to obviously get yourself deep, but at the same time, I don't think they're going to be shying away from taking on the best here. So that, I think, of the group was the real standout tie for me.
Yeah, I think that one is definitely going to be interesting. I still think Lyon are in a different league to Barcelona. If it turns out differently, then I'll hold my hands up quite happily. But Barcelona reached their first semi-final last year. Yes, they've strengthened considerably, but I still see Lyon being a cut above at the moment. No doubt Barcelona will continue to grow and develop. The one that interests me is Montpellier against Chelsea. Montpellier, we know, had a bit of a slippery start, but I actually think that one's a really interesting one, mate. There's some really good players on both sides. Chelsea are absolutely flying in the WSL at the moment. We'll talk about that in the next show because there obviously hasn't been any fixtures for the last week or two. But I really like Montpellier-Chelsea. I think that one could be interesting. I think Wolfsburg-Slavia Prague, I hate to be the cynic again, but I think that's a comfortable one for Wolfsburg. And if we'd seen Linköping with the squad that they've had for the last few months against Man City, I think they would have potentially presented a few problems. But I really don't know what to expect from them because we've just spoken about three big players that they've lost. Man City, again, comfortable winners over LSK in the last 16. I don't necessarily see any surprises with those games between involving Wolfsburg and Slavia and Man City and Linköping. Montpellier-Chelsea is the one I'm not 100% certain. I still expect a Chelsea win, but I expect Montpellier to put up a fight.
Yeah, I think you're right in that because, you know, you look, again, not of the same extent of where Barcelona is, but this is a team, Montpellier, that have really added to their squad over the past year to year and a half. Stina Blackstenius, obviously, kind of the prized possession. I think, what, correct me if I'm wrong, just under a year ago she signed for the team, you know, big striker there. I really like the play of Anouk Dekker, obviously, in the Euros. So I think she's been really solid, you know, over this past year or so. And yeah, I mean, that's a tough squad. I don't think those two matches against Chelsea are going to be easy. You know, it's going to depend on the day again. We saw at times Chelsea, they've needed to be very organized in the first two rounds. But at the same time, you've seen it personally, some of the best free-flowing football in quite a while, especially from an English club. So yeah, it's going to be one of those come the day, who's going to be the team that has the right tactics and the right personnel available, obviously, since this is going to be happening 3 months down the road, actually, you know, on the day, just under 4 months down the road. So there's a lot of time and a lot of elements could happen. Obviously, you can't ever factor out injuries or anything like that. I do, if anything, and I'll hold my hands up too, I might think that Montpellier might have something in them to get through that.
I have to be honest, I've seen too much of Chelsea to kind of think the other way, mate. I'm going Chelsea on that one. I just think that Montpellier will make it very difficult. I think the key thing here, my hope, is that we don't see big one-sided scorelines. We saw a few in the last 16, none bigger than Lyon coming over the team from Kazakhstan, Bilk Kazigar. I think it was 16 or 17 over the two legs. I think Arda Hegerberg got 8 in the two legs. We don't want to see that. Not in the quarterfinals, thank you very much. So hoping for some good close encounters with lots of good football on show. A little bit of a break now until that competition resumes. As I said, last 2 weeks in March, we will have the quarterfinals. And I think we should probably round up Europe, mate, by talking about the situation in Denmark. Obviously, we know that they pulled out of a fixture against Sweden, a World Cup qualifier. I'm almost certain, well, it's not even an almost certain, it will have been a very, very difficult decision for those players to have made. No one wants to pull out of a match, let alone a World Cup qualifier. We weren't sure what sort of punishment would be handed down. Let's be frank, they've suffered enough. But UEFA have handed them a 4-year suspended ban from competitive matches for which it would otherwise qualify after refusing to play in their World Cup qualifying game with Sweden. So I'm a little bit puzzled by that, mate, if I'm honest with you. I understand rules are rules, but the Danish players were already punished enough with the situation that they found themselves in. Thankfully, there's no immediate ban that could potentially take place, but if they find themselves in a situation again where they feel that striking is the only option, their hands are essentially tied, because they know if they strike, there is a 4-year ban potentially waiting for them.
Yeah, I think that's where it comes down to, right? UEFA had a precedent to lay down. Unfortunately, it doesn't come in great circumstances, because, you know, we're in an age right now where, especially in women's sports, they're not only fighting for the equality in terms of pay, but equality in terms of conditions as well. So, yeah, there's a lot that comes down to it, but I think I've said it publicly before on this show, and I'll say it again. I am one of those people that you do have to, in a tournament format or qualification format, you must adhere to the rules. And if you don't, then there are punishments. I'm with you in the sense that the players have already suffered enough. Yes, but this is one of those where, you know, you have teams, remember, some that are getting trounced 10-0 in these qualification matches and don't have really any of the not to say luxuries, but any of the opportunities that some of these other players have, but they're still going out and playing the matches. So it's a hard one for me, but at the end of the day, like I said, I'm one of those that I do kind of tend towards the rules. It's unfortunate because of the circumstances, but, you know, hopefully with this being the case, that we don't see any more striking, or if you will, or not to say non-protesting, because we want players to obviously fight for what they believe in, but at the same time, with these matches, you have to still play them in order to get to the bigger stages.
No, I'm not having it, mate. I'm on the other side. I'm all for the rules, of course, but Denmark were left in a very, very difficult position, and as I say, I'm almost certain it was very difficult to make that decision that they did, and I think UEFA making the punishment they did was just sticking the boot in a little bit further. But I hope that that one doesn't come back to bite them on the backside, because, as I said, any decision that they make in the future could potentially see them get a 4-year ban from international competition, and we don't want that to happen, because this Denmark side is immensely talented and of huge potential, and we saw that at the Women's Euros. I don't want to get on my high horse on that one, mate, because you probably won't stop me. I already had a rant in the last episode about what's going on at Watford Ladies, so I think we'll leave that one there. I want to finish up a little bit differently. It's a slightly shorter episode, but as we say, we've already spoken to Ashley on the show. I got in touch with a journalist called Tom Marshall, who's based in Mexico, and he actually attended the final of the Mexican League that launched this year. It was a two-legged final, and it was between Chivas and Pachuca. It was a two-legged final. Across the two legs, there were over 50-odd thousand supporters. I think it was 32,000 in the second leg, somewhere between 25 and 30,000 for the first leg. Tom was definitely the second leg, and I had a chat with him about how that's been received in Mexico, how the league has gone, what the response has been, were those crowds consistent throughout the year, because I haven't seen any of that league. Really interested to get some insight. So here's myself and Tom having a chat about the Mexican league. Okay, so I'm really pleased to be joined by ESPN journalist Tom Marshall, actually based out in Mexico, who has been following the Mexican Liga Femenil since its inception this year. Tom, I mean, we were talking very shortly before coming onto recording, and you said it was a bit of a surprise when this popped up. Just for those that maybe don't know much about the league, can you give a bit of, maybe a little bit of background as to how it came about?
Yeah, hi, Kieran. Thanks for the invite, for having me on. And yeah, I mean, basically last December, there was a league owners meeting, and then kind of they announced a few changes for the men's side of the league, and then all of a sudden, oh yeah, and we're starting a women's league as well. And everyone was kind of taken aback. But yeah, and I mean, obviously there were teething problems. There was a cup competition, I believe, in the spring, and then this season the Apertura, they went for the league, and basically it's modelled, or it's the men's teams, and then they've all now got a women's side, apart from two. So there's 16 teams in the league. You know, it's obviously a massive and ambitious move by the league and the Mexican Federation. And yeah, obviously the culmination of all that work was the final last week, with, you know, 29,000 at the first leg and then 32,000 in the second leg. You know, really momentous occasion for the women's game in Mexico.
Yeah, of course, it was Chivas Guadalajara overcoming Pachuca, wasn't it, in that two-legged final? You, as you said, two really well-attended legs in the final. Have you seen the kind of competition grow in popularity as the season has gone on? You will know, you were telling me before we came on to recording, you've been in Mexico for 9 years, you cover Mexican football in depth on the men's side. What's been the reaction on the female side? Is that attendance representative of what's been happening across the league, or is it something that's gradually grown over the year?
I think it's been a gradual thing. Obviously, the first, you know, the first matches, there was a lot of attention on how it would go, but what we've seen, I think, through this season is that, and I think this is one of the strengths of the way that they've used the, you know, the men's teams that are obviously very well established. Some of them, you know, over 100 years old. I mean, real institutions, these that everyone, every Mexican obviously will know. And because the women's team has taken the same names and the part of the same institution, I feel like, I don't know how to say it, but it's almost like there's a real pressure. It's created a pressure for these institutions, especially the bigger ones, to make sure that the women's team is up to scratch and that isn't letting the institution down. And I think that's what we've seen. I think we've seen some of the big clubs, when they didn't get good results, they've all of a sudden sat up taking criticism from the public and saying, why aren't you putting enough resources into the women's side? And I think from there, I think that's really fueled the league. You know, the fact that there are already fans there, and we saw it in the final. I mean, and the semi-finals, to be fair, where fans really showed up, they wore the colours, and they went out there and supported the team. So yeah, I mean, obviously, I think bit by bit over the season, things have picked up, even in terms of TV coverage. At the start, none of the games were shown on TV. And then, you know, Fox have come in, I think Marca Claro have come in and also shown games. So, I mean, it's increased the visibility of the league as well. And I think people have, you know, really, really got behind it, to be honest. I've been really pleasantly surprised by the reaction to this league.
You attended, I know, the second final. What was the atmosphere like? Did you find that it was similar to a men's game? Or I know that from my own experience of attending women's games in England and in Europe and in the US, the crowd seemed to be a little bit different to those that you'd get at a men's game. How does it compare in Mexico?
To be honest, I didn't see too many differences. I think that they call it in Mexico the porra, or the barra brava. They showed up, so they were behind the goal, you know, chanting, bringing the atmosphere basically with the drums and all that. And then obviously there was women got in free to the second leg in Guadalajara, so I think that boosted the attendance as well. And yeah, I don't know, I think it was the same. I mean, Chivas, the men's team, played a final back in May. And you know, comparing that final to the women's final last Friday, you know, there wasn't a massive difference. I mean, people were extremely excited, and when the final whistle went, it was just absolute mayhem. I mean, people were, just going crazy as if it was the men's team. I think that there's a real kind of solid base to work from now moving forward. I mean, this is what we saw in Mexico. I mean, people can see the videos even if they didn't see the game. We saw like this genuinely can work. I mean, this I think everybody watching that game, both the finals, can see that the potential for this Mexican league is absolutely massive if they can get the next steps right, which I think is going to be, you know, the big question.
It's interesting what you said earlier about the pressures that are put on those teams. When I was doing my research, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, I read that only players born within Mexico are actually able to play for those clubs. If that is right, do we see them potentially changing that rule so that we can get players in from other countries that might raise the profile and generate more interest?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Kieran, I think more than raising the interest, I think it's about quality. And I think that's the next challenge now, because basically there was a massive controversy before this league started, because the league introduced a rule last minute saying that only players born in Mexico. Now, that doesn't just exclude foreigners, that excludes Mexican Americans who were born in the States but to Mexican parents, because the Mexican constitution says that anybody with one Mexican parent is automatically a Mexican citizen on birth. So, you know, the 30 million Mexican-Americans born in the United States to at least one Mexican parent are Mexican, as far as, you know, legally in Mexico. So the fact that the league put in you have to be born in Mexico was really controversial, because we know the history of the women's Mexican national team is that a lot of the time the federation, it's been the easy option, to be honest. They've gone to the United States, they've gone to the colleges, the universities, and they've scouted players with Mexican heritage. Why? Because obviously, you know, the training is so much better up there, the nutrition, everything that surrounds the women's game in the United States is so much better than in Mexico. And they basically took these girls from the States and planted them in the Mexican national team. So the league put in this rule to only allow girls born within Mexico because of that, because they didn't want the teams basically going to the United States, bringing down 15 players, and then basically, I think they would have had a strong chance of winning the league like that, because obviously, culturally, the women's game is so much more advanced in the US than it is in Mexico. So that was really controversial. The other issue is the age limit. I think only two players over the age of 23, I believe, can play in any one match day squad. So obviously you've got a couple of players that are absolutely stand out. I mean, Pachuca had Monica Ocampo, who has been with the national team for absolutely years, and obviously the quality that she brings, the experience that she brings is extremely valuable. But once you've got one player like that, or two players like that, why not four or five, which would help the younger girls, you know, really, you know, just get that experience of playing with international players. And I think that feeds into the Mexican-American side as well. I think that's going to be a massive issue moving forward for the league.
We saw a few years ago a number of Mexican players in the American NWSL. Obviously, the Mexican Federation had a vested interest in that. We didn't see many of them get many minutes on the field. Are we anticipating or hopeful that with this Mexican league and with a number of young players and internationals playing in that competition, that it might have a knock-on effect and we see Mexico starting to prove as a national team as well?
That's the great hope, and that's the idea behind the league. I mean, the Mexican Federation is one of the, it generates a lot of money. I mean, the men's team play minimum five friendlies in the United States, you know, often to over 50,000 people. So they generate money, and it seems like they finally use some of that money to put on the women's side, because it's been so underdeveloped for so many years. So that's the idea. But I think that probably the best approach for the Mexican women's team and development moving forward is to not put your eggs into one basket. So you've got the league, you've got something going on domestically, you've still got the US colleges, which were going to remain a really important facet of developing Mexican players. But also, and this is key here, and I mean, I think we're seeing it's historic at the minute, the amount of Mexican players that are in Europe now is, you know, out of the squad that are playing Costa Rica, that played on Friday and again on Monday, 10 of the 21 players are based in Europe. So you've got Charlin Corral at the minute at Levante, who's the top goal scorer right now in Spain. You know, Kenty Robles, reigning champion with Atletico Madrid. So it's, I think the future does look positive for the women's national team, but obviously this is only a first step. It really has to, it can only be seen as a first step into continual investment, really. That's what required, because the potential for this country in terms of the women's game is absolutely huge.
Mate, that's a really, really interesting insight. And even from my perspective as someone who covers the game a lot, learned a lot in that 10 minutes that you gave us some insight to. I really hope that we can get you back on maybe at the start of next year, mate. Maybe have a look at the new season and any developments that have taken place. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. And yeah, thanks a lot for the invite.
So big thanks there to Tom. JJ, we should round off very quickly, and we wanted to leave it to the end because it's a really, really important topic to discuss. On the day of recording, Ann-Kathrin Berger, former German international goalkeeper playing for Birmingham City Ladies, it was announced today that she's been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. She's due to have surgery next month, and she's going to spend a little bit of time away from the game during her recovery. Really sad news, isn't it? We don't hear too many stories like this, thankfully, but when you do, it really hits home, doesn't it? And I've seen a lot of messages sent in Ann-Kathrin's direction, and really, really nice to see that so many people are supporting her and behind her.
Yeah, I think that's it. And it, you know, we've seen in this community when there's negativity or something that just, you know, doesn't go the way that people want to or hope that it goes, especially in the case here with you know, cancer. I mean, that's just, you never want to hear these things. So I'm super happy for the fact that the community has gotten behind her. At the same time, I think, you know, speaking for both of us, just well wishes to her, hopefully that the surgery, when it's performed, it goes smoothly and without any sort of issues whatsoever. And we hopefully see her back on the field, whether it's for Birmingham or whether it's just any club for that matter. But yeah, this is, it's a tough one to talk about. I think, you know, these are one of those things that you never want to really have chats on, but here we are, still in 2017, and we're having chats about cancer with not only just athletes but people in general. But yeah, best wishes, hope that she gets back out there soon.
Yeah, without question, best wishes to Ann-Kathrin, those associated with Birmingham City Ladies. I know that it's a great club, and they'll look after her, and I'm sure the fans will get behind her as well. But yeah, we should round it up there, mate. Thank you, as always, for your time, listeners. We always appreciate your support and appreciate you downloading the show. JJ, thanks for your time, mate.
Absolutely.
If you wish to get in contact with us, you can do. We're on Twitter on @WosoZone. You can email us on WosoZone@gmail.com. You can get the show and any articles that have gone up recently on womenssoccerzone.com. Until next time, take care of yourselves and bye-bye.